Hi. So this morning I'm going to talk about the self. Someone was here at the first talk, said the last time I gave this talk was 3 years ago. I thought I'd never given it. Somebody else said they'd heard me give this talk three times. Well, there you go. There you go. Memory's not what it used to be, at least mine. So the self. So supposedly the historical Buddha made this radical discovery when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree that we don't exist as separate beings, that we get identified with this limited idea, belief in ourselves, and that it's an illusion. And that we suffer, and it removes us from the freedom and mystery of interdependent co-arising. That's favorite Buddhist term. And, you know, I was talking to someone about it the other day, and I said, codependent inter-arising. Which is not exactly the same. As a matter of fact, you could almost say they're polarities, right? Interdependent co-arising. Everything is part of this orchestra that's just going on and on and on. All life is part of this orchestra. And our so-called self is part of that orchestra too. And our so-called self is made out of, as those of you who've been around for a while, five changing processes. The five skandhas, the five aggregates. The changing process of form in the body, the changing process of feelings and sensations that come from the body, the changing process of perceptions that we have about the feelings, the sensations come from the body, the impulses or mental tendencies that then arise, that's the fourth one. The impulses or mental tendencies that arise as a process. And the fifth one is vijnana, consciousness that ties it all together by talking about it. By talking about it. The author. It thinks, consciousness thinks it's an author because it's trying to tie it all together. Huh. But it's not exactly the way it is. We develop this sense of one abiding self. Whenever we grasp that or identify with a series of patterns, and we do that. It's part, we do that to survive. It's part of human survival. And we select patterns that are, there's a selection that goes on. Who is the we that selects them? The fifth one is the we that selects them, the one that talks to itself based on our need to survive and our need to feel connected to people. All that stuff. And then out of that, we create roles. We create roles. A woman, a man, a father, a son, a teacher, a student. We grasp limited identities. And then we want to protect and defend them. And the more we need to protect them and defend them, the more we feel to see that they're limitations. Or their deficiencies. And then we kind of just push-pull with everything and everyone to defend these. And sometimes we do this unconsciously, and sometimes we do this consciously. And sometimes it happens through our culture, and sometimes we do it more on our own. A hero, a lover, a mother, a screw-up, an adventurer, a thief. So when I was a young man at the Zen monastery in California, there was a guy, David, there, who was the clown. He was definitely the clown. And he got away with a lot of stuff. Coming late, and because he lightened everything up with his clowniness. And, you know, we needed lightening up in those monasteries. We were a little bit kind of hard-ass about everything. So he was the clown. That was his role. He got a reinforcement for doing that. He could come late. He had such a good sense of humor, and he was so friendly to anybody that nobody else could come late. David could come late and get away with it, because that, and that role worked for him. So he kept that role for the whole summer. I don't know if he kept it after the summer. Well, later he became an author, so. And he didn't mention his clownsmanship anymore. So most of us have more than one persona. You know, when you're with your friend from college, you're different than when you're with your boss. How you interact in a class here is differently than how you're going to interact at tea time, for the most part. So we have these, we develop these patterns, and these patterns conglomerate into personalities. And they're affected basically by three patterns, three factors from a Western point of view: genes and biology, nurturance and culture, nurturance or lack of nurturance, and personal constructs and goals. For instance, I have a friend named Paul, and I'm not using his real name, who is an introvert. He says, I'm an introvert. And he's an introvert genetically, because even when he was a tiny baby, he didn't like a lot of noise. He wanted to be by himself. His mother said, I knew he was an introvert when he came out. Well, of course, you could say she conditioned him, but we won't get into that. He was an introvert, and he was an only child. As an only child, he was a quiet family. His introversion was encouraged, so he calls himself an extreme introvert. But then his stepson turned 21 and wanted to have a party. So what did Paul do? He planned the party. He socialized with everyone. He hung out for the whole party. He visited with everyone. So he had a personal construct. Personal construct that I want to relate to this kid. I love this kid as my own. So I'm going to put my introversion aside and just do this. And one side of my family, there are Indian in-laws from India, and Indians generally look at this a little differently. They think that personality and it does not come from heredity, does not come from environment, does not come from personal construct. It comes primarily from reincarnation and the alignment of the stars when you were born. Reincarnation and the alignment of the stars when you were born. That's interesting. That's interesting. So, years ago, my grandmother, who was into astrology, paid some Indian person in San Francisco to do my chart. Very big chart, you know, with my sun sign and my rising sign and my moon sign and my this sign and my that sign. And she did it, and I read it, and it didn't seem too much like me. And then she said, oh dear, I got your time of your birth wrong. You weren't born at 5 a.m. You were born at 2 a.m. She's going to have to redo your chart. So she redid my whole chart based on the time of my birth at 2 a.m., not at 5 a.m. Well, it came out all differently, and it sounded more like me. So, but was that my own projection? Because I like that pattern? Or maybe the Indians know the one true way, doing it by the stars. I don't know. And when we put all of our different selves into one singular identity, as we do, for expedience sake, to get along, then we become kind of attached to that. And then when things don't go the way we expect them to go, or go like they've been going, we might say, I'm not myself today. And you ever say to yourselves, I'm not myself today? Well, you're not those familiar patterns that you think are yourself. I'm not myself today. When people say that in my family to them, that say that to me in my family, I want to give them a little Dharma talk, but I know that's not good. I know it's better not to go down that road. So So I'm a first child. I'm a boy. I was a CEO of two nonprofits for more than 20 years. I was president of the board of directors here and years and years ago for 5 years. And then I've been guiding teacher here for 17, 18 years. So talk about an identity to get kind of attached to, right? So some of you heard me tell this before, but I went to therapy with my wife once. And not, honestly, this was probably 15 years ago. No, I probably did it 15 years ago. And she said, "You're not my CEO." I thought, "What? I'm not her CEO." She said, "You're not my CEO." The therapist looked at me and Linda looked at me. Katagiri, the founding teacher here, I remember going, I just got back from a vacation to the Caribbean. I've always gone, I love to go on vacations. Now as I get older, I go on longer ones. He said, "You go on vacation, what that?" I said, "Well, you know, we take time off. We go do something fun. He said, "Oh, we stay at temple. We sit every morning. Vacation, that's strange." But that was when he first came here, but then he hung out here for a few years. We all kept going on vacation. Finally, people talked him into doing it. He said, "Oh, I do that, but that hard." That hard. Well, you know, we get it. Even a Zen teacher we get attached to our roles. We get attached to them. So how can we see our roles? Especially the ones that we identify with, and how can we move beyond them to experience more fluidity, more resilience? My father was a litigator, professional litigator, he liked to litigate all of us. He also liked to litigate my grandmother, not his mother, but my mother's mother was a liberal Democrat, and my dad was sure not that. And he liked to litigate when he was with her. And I remember my mother saying one time, "You know, we're going to see my mom, and please, please put your litigation self aside. I know there's another self in there. Put it aside, and just be there and try to smile and be present, pleasant. And if she brings up Teddy Roosevelt or John F. Kennedy, just smile at her." So he tried it. He worked on it. And then I remember one time after he did it, he said to me afterwards, "Ah," he said, "she really drove me crazy when she was talking about FDR. And he said, "Let's have a swimming race." So he needed a race with his son to swim, to get his litigation out of him. He was not that good a swimmer. I beat him. So it takes energy to move beyond the selves that we identify with, the roles that we identify with. It takes energy. But we can develop awareness of our multiple identities, there are multiple patterns, without clinging to any of them. That's partly what Zen practice is about. Maybe that's largely what Zen practice is about. You know, I'm all these things, you're lots of things. I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm an author, I'm a friend, I'm a Zen teacher. And then I'm some selves I don't like I'm an MSNBC junkie. Well, you know, I am. But I haven't done it for a month, so maybe my addiction is gone, but we'll see. We'll see. But the more we're aware of our different identities, the more degrees of freedom we have. Just to be aware of them, not to try to fight about them inside, but just to be aware of them. So our first step is to be aware. of how we change our speech, how we change our body posture, how we change our facial expressions, how we change our behaviors, depending on the context of a situation and the people. Our second step is to accept and embrace different ways of being. Gives us freedom, gives us flexibility. And our third step is to act in ways that go beyond our typical personality and beyond our comfort zone, as Paul did with his son. This means acting out of character. That's what Zen practice partly is, acting out of character, stepping beyond this limited character that I have. Surprising ourselves when we act out of character. Learning something that we didn't know. Our identity expands. We're more enlightened because we lighten up. And of course, we still probably need, when we do this practice, to go back to some restorative niches after we've done it. Go back in our turtle shell for a little while. That's why we have a turtle shell. That's okay. That's part of being human. We need to go back to restorative niches. And Zen practice is about discovering this resilience, discovering it, and learning how to enjoy and access all our different selves, all our different patterns, and partly by taking on new tasks or new problems that shake our stability and move us to grow. I've worked with a lot of people over the years, first as a therapist and then here, who identify themselves as being depressed or identify themselves as having anxiety disorder. Or sometimes is it that you get them combined, like anxious depression. Well, yeah, that's important. It's not surprising that people come here with those, because that's what meditation is about, is deepening our experience so we're not caught by our depression or our anxiety. But first we have to take care of them. And we do come to realize through this practice that our depression is this, but then there's all this other stuff beyond our depression. By stepping beyond the limitations of our depression. Stepping beyond its limitations. So this morning, I don't know if any of you are depressed right now, but if you are, you came here anyway. You sat still for an hour. You say you have an anxiety disorder? Well, you're all sitting here for an hour, being still. Oh, I don't know, maybe, sure. Okay, you have an anxiety disorder, but that's not entirely who you are. You stay still here for an hour, 2 hours. So what I like to do, and I've often done, is quote Walt Whitman, "I am large, I contain multitudes." You're large, you contain multitudes. We can find those hidden parts and allow them to grow. Sometimes they're just glimmers. When I used to be a therapist, what I would do is counsel people who were depressed to do something. They could go on meds, but better just to do something. I say, "Oh, I'm too exhausted." But actually, if you're exhausted because of your depression, you do something, it works. You just have to take that step out of the shell. It works. Sometimes better than meds. Sometimes at least as a wonderful compliment to meds. And you might also have your different selves, your different patterns that are in competition or in conflict. And then just learning to share the stage, find the balance. Well, who is learning it? Who's finding a balance? Well, there's no you doing it. It's just happening. It's happening through your being in the world. In a way, there is a self that's doing it. That's the fifth skanda. That's consciousness. That's talking to yourself. But you really have to move beyond that to experience this. So in deep meditation, then, we untangle this dense thicket. And I can't even say that we untangle it, because who untangles it? This dense thicket of small, constricted patterns that define us gets untangled by focusing on our breathing, on each sensation, each thought, by discovering that none of these are solid, they're all moving, by working with a mentor. Many people have mentors here, well, that's good. I'm mentoring people. Others are. That's helpful. So this this rendition of Buddhism that I've just given you comes from the Theravada tradition, the tradition of the elders. Theravada means elder, the Theravadins. And the modern day manifestation of the Theravadins is here in this country is people who mostly who practice Vipassana. If you go to a Vipassana meditation retreat or a Vipassana center, people who practice Vipassana, people from IMS, people like Tara Brach and Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. And, of course, we do this practice in Zen, too. But we have also another tradition in Zen, and that's the Mahayana tradition. The Mahayana tradition. So the Mahayana tradition, which starts 500 years after the Theravada tradition, says, well, there actually is a self. And Buddha talked about it, but he didn't think people were ready for it. So and for 500 years, the Nagas protected this truth from coming out to the general public. But now in the second century AD in India, it's ready to come out to the general public. There is a self. And in the Tathagata Garbha Sutra, it says there's both a conventional self, which is a fabrication of different patterns that we identify with, and a Buddha self within us, which is identified with all life. It's changeless, that's deathless, that's our true self, that's the embryonic Buddha nature. Buddha nature meaning still nature, meaning awake nature. Not like there's a deity in there. The Buddha nature, the still awake nature. And through practice, we tap into it. And the Nirvana Sutra also, which is much better known than the Tathagata Garbha Sutra. Second century. Here's the Nirvana Sutra. It is not true to say that all phenomena are devoid of a self. So they're contradicting 600 years of Buddhism. It's not true. The self is reality. The self is eternal. The self is virtue. The self is everlasting. The self is stable. The self is peace. It endures forever. No death can touch it. No harm can befall it. No unhappiness can blight it. It is as indestructible as and radiant as a diamond. Highest and everlasting happiness. So when I was with my teacher many years ago, I've told this story many times, but maybe not. Maybe some of you haven't heard it. I know some of you haven't heard it because some of you I don't even know. So when I was with my teacher years ago, there was a younger teacher. I mean, I was in my 20s. There was maybe a teacher in his 40s. My teacher was in his 60s who had stopped in to spend some time with us. And this younger teacher told me I had great potential. Anne remembers this story. He told me I had great potential. He said, I think you had a mini enlightenment experience. And I thought, how did he know? How did he know? He had great potential. He said, if you come with me, I'm going to start a center, and I won't ignore you. Suzuki was ignoring me, right? I won't ignore you. I will cultivate you so you can live a completely enlightened life. So I was, woo, woo. I was big time seduction, right? Spiritual seduction, big time. Big time. Well, I don't know if Suzuki was eavesdropping or if he was psychic. I still don't know. But one day after this teacher, who I will not name, because later he became a kind of well-known, renowned teacher, had a little chat with me, and I was kind of panting and telling Linda, come on, Linda, we got to move from San Francisco, da-da-da. My wife, that is. Suzuki said to me, standing in the hall, is what I remember after meditation, he said, you have a great treasure within you. And he went like this and pointed to his nose. Now, why he pointed to his nose, I don't know. He said, don't let anybody take that from you. Someone may want to take that from you. Be careful. So I stayed with him. Flattery will get you everywhere. Well, of course, they were both flattering me. So you have a great treasure within you. You do. This is key Mahayana Zen. That's what Mahayana Zen is. You have this treasure. You have this stillness. Or you could say it has you. We don't know. Nobody has anything. It's here. It's just here. And the practice is, all we do is live a moral lifestyle and do the meditation, and we clear away the clutter of our minds. Or we could say it clears away itself, so that we experience this, what the Nirvana Sutra calls radiant shining. Radiant shining. So we have these two complementary components to our Zen practice, noticing the array of changing selves, changing roles, without judging or criticizing, experimenting ways of going beyond their limitations, beyond our so-called little self, it's expanding it. That's the Theravada way, the way of the elders. And then the Mahayana way, feeling, tapping into, and feeling a calmness that's here, a quietness, a spaciousness that underlines and surrounds all these little selves, a.k.a. big self. Whatever. Whatever. So here's Suzuki, my teacher. And you guys have read this many times probably, but it's one thing to read these things, and it's another thing to just let them percolate in our consciousness so we're more, it's not a thought anymore. It gets into our skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. You yourself, Suzuki says, make the waves in your mind. If you leave your mind as it is, it will become calm. Big mind experiences everything within itself. Do you understand the difference between the two minds? The mind which includes everything and the mind which is related to something? Actually, they are the same thing, but the understanding is different, and your attitude toward your life will be different according to which understanding you have. So those are the two facets of our practice. And our practice I said to someone the other day, the practice of nirvana. But I was talking, and then I explained, etymologically, nirvana means, from the Sanskrit, nibbana, means to cool by blowing. So, by breathing, by blowing in and blowing out, we cool down. We see these different personas, we're not caught by them, and we experience some coolness inside. Some coolness. So we can free ourselves through this practice from our extreme roles. Maybe we're never completely free. I mean, I had to have my wife say, you're not my CEO. Oh, boo, I'm not her CEO. She said, and you've never been my CEO. I've never been her CEO. I'm never. And then she added, you never will be my CEO. Ooh, ooh. Who's a Zen teacher here? Who's a Zen teacher? So we free these parts from their extreme roles. They learn how to work together as a team. And we feel some calmness, some stability right here. And our breathing, our nirvana breathing, to cool by breathing. Again, etymologically, spirit means breath. To be in good spirits is to be in good breathing. When we're in bad spirits, we're not in good breathing. We're in bad breathing. Notice it. When you're in good spirits, usually you're in good breathing. So we practice nirvana, cool by blowing, so we can be in good breathing, in good spirits, as much as possible. Sometimes we'll be in bad spirits, but we can always come back. We can always do that. So that's what I want to say this morning, and I'm happy to take questions or comments from anybody. Yeah.
I think it's funny that you brought up this topic. I'm, you know, I'm a member in Toastmasters, and I'm currently preparing for a speech that's about the transformation into the authentic self.
Uh-huh.
Which is an idea that my favorite author proposes anyway, but the speech starts off by talking about, you know, how we can kind of pretend to be people that we're not.
Yeah.
In an effort to try and
be
people.
Yeah.
And I think it's obvious why we do that is because you can get so afraid of being alone sometimes.
Yeah.
So you're just trying to relate to people.
Yeah. So, yeah. Exactly.
So
in
becoming the authentic self, I decided to become a member of Toastmasters because, public speaking scares me shitless.
Mm-hmm. Well, good for you. That's your Zen practice is doing that. Yeah.
And, I kind of really dislike myself for being afraid of public speaking because I think it's rooted in the fact that I'm afraid of how people perceive me and what they're thinking of me. And so, well, it's because of that that I decided that I dislike that piece of myself, that, well, I decided to become myself, and that means that I'm not allowed to be afraid anymore, in a sense. And maybe that's not the right way to go about doing it, because in preparing for the speech, what I also started to realize is that if you want to overcome a piece of yourself or leave something behind, you can't teach yourself how to dislike that piece and try and...
You can't teach yourself how to what?
How to dislike that
piece
and, like, rip it off.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's you have to teach yourself that we're a human being, and numerous faults and vast shortcomings, but it's when you come to recognition of that that you really start to become a different person altogether.
Mm-hmm.
The authentic self is what I call it anyway.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, that sounds good to me. It's important that we notice our negative selves, our negative roles, and not diss those, because the dissing of the negative roles creates a new negative one. So instead of subtraction, this is addition. You're adding something by preparing to do Toastmasters. If you think you're subtracting and you're going to get rid of something, you ain't going to get rid of it. And then you're going to create an additional barrier. So it's addition, not subtraction. Good for you. Good for you. And authentic. Yeah, I use the term authentic too, but from the Theravada view, this authentic self is just being in the world, just expressing ourselves fully, just being where we are. And then, of course, the Mahayana view is the authentic self is still calm spaciousness. So neither of those match exactly. But who cares what matches? Really. We don't have to have everything totally congruent intellectually to live deeply and joyfully. Thank you for sharing that. Who else would like to share something or ask something? Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Your words are obviously very deliberate, but I wanted to ask if there's a deliberate choice in your wording when you talk about small self, no self, and big self.
Yeah.
The difference between that and small mind, no mind, big mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, Suzuki, my teacher, he's the big mind teacher. So, I mean, not that other. In his English, when he introduced big mind and small mind, and now it's all over the place. It's a little bit more from the Buddhist scriptures. Any of you taking the Yogacara class with Ben? So, Vijnanavada, consciousness only is reality. That's big mind. That means that all life is included in this dance, and this dance is not just our thinking, but it's big mind. But I would say that it's also big self, big mind, big self. But actually, big mind is used more frequently than big self, except in the Nirvana Sutra and the Tathagatagarbha Sutras, where they actually talk about self. I don't know if that helps you. Carrie.
Kind of relating to what you said, I remember you've told me in the past that those parts of you or me that I wanted to move away from, like things potentially that are causing me pain,
mm-hmm.
even physical pain,
mm-hmm.
can I love those parts?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that's all, that statement blew my mind when you said that to me. Like, why would I want to love my back pain? I want it to go away.
Mm-hmm.
I want to cut it out of my life.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
I try everything I do to,
yeah.
you know, to make that go away.
Yeah.
What if it is about moving closer
yeah.
to that, to yeah. embracing that, to
yeah.
accepting it?
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Very much.
Add a little bit more to that?
Oh, well, let's see, what's the... we don't like these negative parts of ourselves. I don't like the fact that my wife and kids, they don't do this anymore, used to call me a skinflint. I don't like that. And that hurts my feelings. And yet, there's something in there that I need to pay attention to and be kind to. And it has to do with something about my dad and how he was with me, and I have to be kind to him too, because I got it from my dad. And there's fear in there, that skinflint, that they say that, because I was, you know, doing all this Zen stuff, but still being material clinging in the way I, like, we don't need anything, we can just live in a trailer home, where we did for years. You know, we don't need, I'm a Zen guy, but they didn't want to be Zen guys. So I had to get to know that pain inside that I kind of got from my dad, that fear of not having enough. This is good practice for us. And we never know what's going to come up next that we're going to get a chance to practice with. But our friends usually tell us, if I pay attention to my wife, I usually because she's not, she's pretty straight. I usually know, either I argue with her or I should listen to what she's saying. Arguing is okay too sometimes, but often there's a gem of truth.
Tim?
Yeah.
I didn't hear you mention the word expectations during your talk.
Yeah.
To me, that's kind of interrelated and tied in, and that once we start becoming aware of our roles,
mm-hmm.
we very quickly come to set expectations for ourselves.
That's right.
I should be doing this.
Yes, yes. That's right. We do that. And you know, the process of, you know, making more of a commitment to Zen, I should be wearing my Roxu, and I sold it. Now I'm initiated. I should be. Yeah, we do that. That's human beings do that. And you know, when I talk about that, I talk about how expectation hardens us. And usually underlying expectation, there's aspiration. And if we can get in touch, if I get in touch with the aspiration that caused me to sow this in the first place, that then my expectation loosens up, opens up, and actually somewhat falls away, and I just stay with the aspiration in my heart. As soon as aspiration hardens into expectation, we get all kinds of problems. But we do that as human beings, so we just need to notice that. And then if we can't find the aspiration inside, then why am I doing this in the first place? I'm going to come back to the, why am I doing this in the first place if the aspiration is no longer there? Does that deal with this issue?
Yes, absolutely. Because it seems to me that when we get into a role that we start becoming aware and we think, oh, maybe I want to reduce this in me or I want to increase it. Like the first thing that we need to look at are what are my expectations?
That's right.
Yes, if we can soften those expectations, then it allows us
to
examine it.
Yeah, and if the expectation just comes from something we learned, but our heart, there was never an aspiration, then it's counterproductive to do it. It's not healthy to do it. But this is part of our exploration through our meditation. To find those aspirations, to find those things deep in our hearts. Our life is short. You guys are young, so maybe you don't realize how short your life is. It's short. Check in with your aspiration. Your aspiration. You can find it. You can find it. Below all these roles, below all these stuff that you're thinking, worrying about, you all have an aspiration. We all have. And it's connected to other people. It just is. Or maybe it's to animals. Or maybe it's to plants. It's connected. An aspiration is, in your heart, is connected to other hearts.
So I have a question that kind of...
Sure.
And I'm not sure I can articulate it properly, so forgive me, but...
Well, then articulate it improperly.
I feel like I somewhat have a fear, and maybe this is cultural, but a fear of losing my individual self in my efforts to be one with the collective self, the bigger self.
Yeah, but don't make an effort to be one with the collective self, with the bigger self. Don't make an effort to do that. Just breathe. Just breathe. Just be in spirit. Just be in good spirit. See what happens. See what happens. No need to make an effort to be with some big self that somebody told you about. Discover what's inside through your own breathing. Through your own practice, through your own life. And of course, people do in retreats sometimes have experiences where all of a sudden their chattering stops and they think, oh, I thought I wanted to let go of my chattering, but who am I without it? Well, that happens. That happens. And who are you without it? So I say that then maybe you need to go back into a restorative niche, meaning that don't push yourself. Just take a break from your meditation and have a cup of tea and breathe, because we don't want to push ourselves beyond opening our heart in a gentle way. You can have that. Have you sat retreats before?
That
happened.
Huh?
Well, that's cool. Good for you. It means you're very close, and yet you're wanting to protect yourself. So then protect yourself for a while, but then come back and breathe. Or protect yourself as you're breathing. And then it will happen more spontaneously, and you won't be scared anymore. I mean, not permanently. Nothing's permanent. But you'll develop some stability in your consciousness.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that happens in retreats to a lot of people. I thought I wanted to get calm, but this calm? I don't think I want to be this calm that I don't even know who I am. Anybody else? Thank you.